Hello and welcome. This week, the Natural Selection presents Climbing. Hello, welcome back, listeners. Thank you for joining us. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, I am Naomi, and I am joined by Nick.
Hey, hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
Hi, guys, how are you doing today?
Good. It's another beautiful grey day in Berlin.
Nice. Yeah, it's similarly grey here. We had some snow, actually, a few days ago. It was kind of nice. I woke up and stared out the window for a while at the snow flurry.
Winter Wonderland.
Yeah, like London exploded because it was like something to do.
Yeah, a reason to go outside other than boredom. Yeah. Yeah, it didn't really stick where I am very much, but I could see it. I knew it was there.
My niece got to throw her first snowball. So I really hope she threw it at my sister, her mother. But I did ask my sister, like, but you showed her who was boss, right? Like, you've got years of experience on her. You should really, like, you know, really teach her a lesson on, you know, not to mess with the elders.
Yeah.
We got this.
Yeah. Well, the three of us did get to share in somebody's very adult first snow, which was quite a delight. Didn't we, Nick? Were you not there?
I was, but the way you phrased that made it sound a lot weirder than it was.
No, not an adult themed first snow. The person whose first snow it was an adult.
They were from Peru, and we were in class, and it suddenly started, like, absolutely, like, throwing it down with snow. So we went out for a snowball fight, which I remember. We were like, we'll have a snowball fight, but she'd never had one before. So all it was is we just threw snowballs at her while she smiled at us.
So, Nick, would you like to tell any new listeners who we are?
Yeah, we are the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each week, we gather and talk about different topics in the natural world. In the first section of our podcast, we talk about nature news and the interesting research that's happened in the last week or so. And in the second section, we talk about a different theme each week and how it relates to flora and fauna around the world.
So, Nick, would you like to tell any new listeners who we are?
Yeah, we are the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each week, we gather and talk about different topics in the natural world. In the first section of our podcast, we talk about nature news and the interesting research that's happened in the last week or so. And in the second section, we talk about a different theme each week and how it relates to flora and fauna around the world. This week's theme is climbing.
So, Nick, would you like to kick us off with the news?
For news this week, just by chance, I stumbled into an article combining the themes of our last two episodes, which I thought was, wow, I can't pass this one up. But it was on the front cover of the Science publication this week. It's about spitting cobras. And if you remember our last two episodes, you'll be able to put two and two together and figure out that this is about convergent evolution of venom in spitting cobras. So some researchers, huge group, international team, we're looking at the evolution of different components in the venom of the spitting cobras, which is a monophyletic group or one sort of family, one branch of these snakes. And they're looking at how venom is used differently in these two different, in these snakes versus in other snakes. And it seems like in most snakes, venom is used mostly directed at the prey. So it's intended to either stop or paralyze or incapacitate or kill or in some way allow the snake to better hunt and eat their prey. But in the case of spitting cobras, they've sort of switched their venom around. So it's not mostly directed at prey, but mostly directed at their predators. And this team of researchers was trying to figure out how it happened and if it happened once or more than once. And the way they were looking at this was in the biochemistry. So they were looking at the different components of the venom, which, if you remember our venom episode last week, the venom of these cobras is cytotoxic. So basically, it's sort of killing individual cells that it gets into contact with. And what they've done, these cobras, in three different species of cobra, so it's happened three independent times in the cobra lineage, is they've increased this a specific type of toxin in their venom called phospholipase A2, which is a venom that acts specifically on the sensory neurons of mammals, which, to quote the article, causes enhanced pain, which they were saying was probably due to the fact that this group of snakes probably experienced more predation in its recent evolutionary past than other related species. So it needed to sort of evolve something that would allow it to respond to this increased predation. And so it evolved this way of causing enhanced pain.
Are those the ones that can make you go blind?
Yeah.
Because that would make sense, yeah, because if the venom kills individual cells,
and yeah, wherever it went. It's specifically designed to affect mammalian sensory neurons, and it gets in your eyes. Yeah.
So watch out.
Uh-huh.
Or close your eyes. I don't know what's better.
Well, that sounds like what this, you know, evolution is, that it's like extra pain, so you know not to mess with them. So my news this week was a piece of research that was published in the Journal of the Royal Society Interface, and it was looking at butterflies and how they fly. So butterflies are interesting compared to other flying animals. They have unusually short, broad, and large wings relative to their body size. So previous studies have looked at how they fly, but they didn't analyze it mechanistically. So other studies suggested that they use the wing clapping together to propel air and help them fly. So this study actually looked and took some aerodynamic measurements of this clap. What they did was they put butterflies in a wind tunnel and they measured how they fly and the aerodynamic properties. Researchers from Lund University looked at this and they found that during the upward stroke, the wings cup, creating an air-filled pocket between them. And then when the wings collide, the air is forced out and this creates a jet that propels the butterflies forward. And then the downward wing beat kind of offsets the butterfly's weight in order to keep them in the air. What's also something they discovered in this research was that the flexibility of the wings was really important. So the flexibility improves their momentum. And so this mechanism might explain their unique wing morphology. Also, this might be something that could be used in the future for drones or other things. And they were able to prove that the flexibility improved this by creating a mechanical flexible wing. And they found that the same results were found.
Naomi, when you said they put some butterflies in a wind tunnel, I have seen some videos of things being tested in wind tunnels, and those things that were being tested were airplanes. So I felt really bad for the butterflies for a second there, but it seems like this was a gentle wind tunnel.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. I was a bit concerned that, but I think perhaps it was so that they could measure it without external forces of air, perhaps. Not really sure fully how wind tunnels work, but the researchers seem to know what they were doing. So that's
thank goodness.
On interesting news, do you know perhaps Lund University's most famous student? He's very relevant to us.
Oh, is his name Carl?
Yes.
Oh, Mr. Linnaeus.
Yeah. He briefly studied at Lund University.
So, Nick, I think you have some intense news for us this week. Well, judging from the title.
I mean, I never really thought of it as intense, but yeah, I suppose the title of the paper is quite intense. It's Male Coercion and Female Injury in a Sexually Cannibalistic Mantis. And this is a study from New Zealand, the University of Auckland, by Nathan Burke and Gregory Holwell. You guys probably know a little bit about praying mantises and how they mate. It's sort of very famous that they are cannibalistic, that the females will cannibalize the males, quite often after mating, but sometimes before, tragically for the male. It basically wanders up to the female and just gets eaten without the benefits of passing on its DNA. So they're observing one specific species, which was Mia mantis caffra. And what they found is the males actually wrestle the females in pre-mating interactions. There's often a violent struggle, and each sex is trying to be the first one to grasp hold of the other with their sort of front legs, their forelegs. When the females win this struggle, they always cannibalize the males. However, When the males grasp first in this sort of forearm struggle, they dramatically increase their chance of mating. Interestingly, though, more than a quarter of the males who won the struggles ended up wounding the females with their claws. And this could cause a loss of hemolymph, or equivalent of blood, and even scar tissue formation. And none of the males which injured the females were actually cannibalized. Because the rate of injury was low, it suggests that this is actually not favored. It's not being selected for, or else the rate of injuring females would be more than 25%. What it suggests is that it's selecting for male coercive tactics, that the male overpowering the female, in this instance to mate, is being selected for. This is actually quite rare in sexual cannibals. Generally, how sexual cannibals will behave is the male is often much, much smaller. How it will approach the female is it will pick the right time when it's least likely to be cannibalized, rather than any sort of overpowering it or sneaky. It will just sort of hope for the best and wander up to it and be like, do you want babies? And hope it doesn't get eaten. Perhaps the biggest factor in this is sexual dimorphism, so body size and the difference in body size. So when the male is much smaller, it has to do this cautious approach. But these ones, they're not actually that much different. So it suggests that, you have to be quite similar in size to sort of display this sort of fighting behavior before mating. But yeah, kind of an interesting look into the sex lives of praying mantises.
That was some cool news. Thank you for that, Nick. So I think with that, that brings us to an end of the news this week. Please do join us after this short break. We'll be back with our theme. Welcome back. This week, I thought I would begin our theme by discussing a new word that I discovered while researching this topic. So that is scansoriality.
You'd never heard of scansoriality?
I hadn't, no. Oh. Yeah.
And I thought you were smart, yeah.
I know, right? Could you
just remind me what it means again? Just for the listeners, you know?
Yes, yeah. So it refers to the ability or the propensity to climb. So an animal that spends at least some of its time climbing is therefore scansorial.
Humans?
I guess, yeah.
Don't get ahead of us, Nick. We'll get there.
So what is something interesting that I found while looking at this topic was the difference between scansoriality and being arboreal. So sometimes they're used interchangeably because if you live in a tree, you probably have to climb there. But there is a little bit of a difference in that you might sometimes climb into a tree, but you may not always live within that tree. So being arboreal means that you live within a tree pretty much all the time and you spend most of your time there. Also, climbing isn't just refers to vegetation. You could also climb rocks, cliffs, waterfalls. So in mammals, there are two main reasons why you might climb a tree. So one is to get resources, and the second might be for safety or access to nesting sites.
Access to your treehouse.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so also, yeah, nesting or cache sites is another reason as well. But there are lots of different mammals that are able to climb, and there's lots of different adaptations that happen as a result of this. So I thought that was a new word that I learned this week that I thought I'd share with you guys. Scansoriality.
Cool. I always love those words that they mean something that we know, but we don't have a word for them. And we don't think of them needing a word until we realize there's a word for them. And we think, like, fossorial is a good one in the same category. It means things that dig. And of course, it makes sense that you'd have fossorial, scansorial, it's a group. And then the other ones that we can think of easy are terrestrial, I guess, would be another one. Or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there's lots of adaptations that animals, particularly mammals, have because of their climbing lifestyle. Nick, did you want to tell us a little bit about some of those?
Absolutely, yeah. So I was looking at primates, and one of my like passionate interests is functional morphology and thinking about how the shape of things influences what they do. So I was looking at primates and the evolution of scansoriality in primates. in sort of the different modifications of the skeleton and behavior that you can see in animals that, like primates, start to move into the trees to do most of their living. And I know that when someone is very interested in a topic, they can get a little bit too detailed. So I'm going to try to keep this fun while also describing a little bit of the detail here, because that's what makes it rich. So some of the things that change in primates is we're looking at things that, okay, we've got a list of things, and I'm just going to blast through them, and we'll see if we can sort of piece together the type of animal that we might have here. They keep their clavicle, which is lost in a lot of other mammals. They have a shoulder joint that allows for a lot of movement around with the upper limb. They have a lot of mobility in the digits, so they can move their fingers quite easily, especially the sort of first digit, the thumb and big toes in us, which are sometimes opposable to the other digits. Their claws are modified into flattened nails. They have sensitive pads on the end of their digits with their fingers, and they have stereoscopic depth perception because their eyes move to the front of their face and they can see like a binocular. And then finally, they have a big brain that coordinates a visual perception. And when I was reading through this, thinking like, oh yes, primates, okay, let's keep the clavicle, blah, 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 I got to the end and realized, oh, I've just read a description of my item self. Because we're from primates.
I mean, humble brag with the big brain, Nick.
Big brain, two eyes in the front of my face. Come on, ladies and gents.
Yeah, isn't that your Tinder profile?
Yeah, yeah. Shares a lot of sensorial adaptations with the rest of the primate clade. Step right this way, please. But no, I thought that was really a cool moment of realization of like, oh, all of these things that are describing what helps things live in trees are true in my body, because they're sort of leftovers from the long, long period of time that we spent doing a lot of things in trees. So the last thing I guess I want to mention is that we're not the only types of primates. There are many other kinds and they do a lot of different things. We walk upright on 2 feet, which is pretty strange for any animal, but especially primates. There's not really any others that do what we do all the time. Some can, but looking at different groups, there's a large group called the anthropoids that walk either on 4 legs along the tops of branches, or they can hang by any of their 4 limbs below the branches. A different group, the sort of other side of the primate branch called the prosimians, are usually like clinging, hanging forms, that's so they can hang from their hands and hold on, or they're leaping, swinging types of movement. And related to that is a type of movement through trees called brachiation, which is, if you think of those like crazy spiders with the tails that like wrap around things, and then they have their long, long arms, and they're like swinging around, like us in the monkey bar, that's why it's called monkey bars. That's called brachiation, and it's a different type of arboreal or scansorial motion or locomotion. So anyway, I thought this was a super cool topic and maybe something worth diving into if you're interested in functional morphology, thinking about primates and the way they move.
I find myself the most aesthetically pleasing primate is the gibbon.
That whole time I misunderstood you, Nick, and I thought you were saying that you found yourself the most aesthetically pleasing primates.
Well, no, not in the sense of how they look. I mean, not to offend any gibbons listening, but how they move through trees.
Yeah, they're very like, oh, it's almost stately, no?
Yeah, there's like long swings with their long limbs. And yeah, I really like watching them.
Yeah, they do definitely look so like casual, like it's so easy for them to just sort of swing through the trees. But like I mentioned, it's not only trees that animals climb in. Others climb on rocks, mountains, hill faces. And there's some interesting adaptations that go along with that.
Yeah, some animals even climb on damn walls, which isn't me being rude. it's a genuine observation. I don't know if you remember, it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago maybe, there was a photo of several animals perched in northern Italy on a water dam, on an almost sheer face of the water dam. Do you guys remember that?
Yes, totally. I actually just today had a recommended video for that, and it's probably because of the research I've been doing this week.
Yeah, so this is a group of animals called the ibex. The one in that particular photo from northern Italy was the alpine ibex, obviously named after the Alps where they reside. And they're quite an interesting group of animals in themselves. They were very, very close to extinction. At one point, they were only found in, I think, northern Italy in the Alps and the Pyrenees in France. And at one point, there was only 100 individuals. So they suffered a huge genetic bottleneck, but now they're trying to be reintroduced to various areas around Europe. And part of the reason was human hunting for the Alpine Ibex. To the point, have you guys ever heard of Ötzi?
Of what?
Ötzi or Ötzi?
No.
No.
He's also called the Iceman. He was a natural mummy that was found in northern Italy on the border with Austria. And he lived between 3400 and 3100 BCE. But he was very, very well preserved. Like, they even found tattoos on his body. And they even found that he was murdered. He was killed by an arrow to the back of the head, I believe. But they were able, he was so well preserved, they were able to look at the contents of his stomach and found out what grains he was eating. And one of his last meals was an Alpine Ibex.
Uh-huh.
They are Ibex. There's various different species. You get Nubian ones, which you can find in the Middle East, places like Israel. There's some in Ethiopia and Northern Africa. But this one, particularly the Alpine Ibex or the Capra Ibex. Yeah, all Ibex are a type of mountain goat. They are famous for living in the mountains. You guys in America, I believe, have your own types of mountain goats, which are not Ibexes.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also famous for their climbing. So it appears goats are very, very good at sort of living on this rough terrain. And it does offer some really, really good advantages. Because if you can survive at the top of a sheer cliff face, generally predators aren't going to go up there to try and catch you. So they often find it a really, really useful place to raise youngsters, especially if they can find food up there, because it keeps the young safe. So what were they doing on this wall? And if you imagine a water dam, they are really, really steep. So what they found is that actually the rocks this was made from, when they get wet, they were exuding salts and calcium, which was really, really important for these ibex. So they were actually going up there to lick the rocks. And there were some studies done on when they observed them walking on this wall. And the slopes of these walls were almost vertical in many instances. And what they found was they focused on, well, they found there was 54 animals in total, and they filmed them. And their body mass was estimated at medium size, small size, and children. And interestingly, no large males were observed moving on these very, very steep walls. So, yeah, this implies that climbing performance is negatively influenced by body mass. They also found, while looking at them, that the friction coefficient between the hooves and the dam walls was in a range higher than rubber on concrete surfaces. So they've got incredibly grippy feet. Hooves, sorry, rather than feet, I suppose. But they were also, so they were looking at how they're able to do this. And the parabolic shape of the hoof wall, which is the very outside of the hoof, appears to add strength. They have really interesting feet. So rather than, like, if you imagine a horse's hoof, where it's sort of like one collective thing, the goat's hoof is split into two, and each one can work independently. So they can actually just stand on one half of their foot, which is really, really useful when there's not a lot of ground. And they can gain purchase this way. Also, the inside is sort of like a concave shape, which suggests that, yeah, it could actually get around rocks. And the inside is a very, very soft material, which might be able to form around any irregular shapes, giving them more grip. They can also, if there is a wider space, they can splay their toes to give a larger contact area, which obviously give more grip. If you imagine holding onto something by by splaying your fingers, it makes it a bit easier. If you, like, you know, on a glass window or something, if you splay your fingers, you can see it's harder to pull your hands down. Interestingly, though, despite all these adaptations, do you know how most mountain goats and ibex allegedly die?
They fall off mountains.
Yeah, they fall to their death. So, yeah, it is a big, big risk for them. But you can see them. There's these amazing photos of them in what seem to be the most unlikely of places. And they genuinely do look like they're defying gravity, which is quite amazing. What I found interesting is about how they climbed up is they observe them. When they climb up, they zigzag. So they sort of go left, 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 right, 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 sort of going horizontally across the wall, finding as best grip they can. When they go down, they found they're actually much more likely to just go straight down. So literally almost running down sheer rock faces. And they can go down twice as fast as they go up.
Not for me.
No.
No. No.
Wow, that is really... Yeah, that was something that I noticed. I hadn't really thought about that sort of like animal, like ibexes or goats being climbing, but then, like, when you think about it, I've seen so many pictures of them, like you said, and just these really unlikely locations, like at the very top of a mountain or something. It's really impressive. Some really cool physiological adaptations they have. Something that I looked up, an animal that I decided to look up when I was thinking about this climbing and life in kind of trees and at height, was sloths. So they're really fun and classic example, I think, of sort of an arboreal animal. As I mentioned, that's an animal that lives and spends most of its life in trees. So there's some things that I found as well, some myths that I guess I could dispel as well, some things that I thought were true and found that they weren't. There are two groups of sloths alive today. There are the two-toed sloth and the three-toed sloth. But prior to this, we mentioned in a few episodes ago, there were other kinds of sloths, ground sloths. And something that I found out today was that it seems most likely that given the scope of fossils that have been found, that ground sloth was much more like the classic, typical sort of sloth. And what we have today is it's kind of a bit more of an anomaly as far as sloths go. So these sloths that are found today are found in Central and South America in tropical rainforests. They are a member of the Xenartheria. And what's interesting about this group is that they have some, as you can potentially pick up from the etymology of the name, they have some interesting changes to their joints. So the word means foreign or strange, and artheria means joint. So this group tend to have different changes to their spine and those joints. But particularly sloths, as a general rule, mammals have 7 cervical vertebrae. So they have 7 neck vertebrae, except for sloths and manatees. So sloths can have up to 3 extra neck vertebrae. And what this allows them to do is that they can turn their necks 270 degrees. Yeah, this is really useful because they can be predated upon from both above and below. So their predators include jaguars, humans, eagles. So it's really important that they have this long view. Their arboreal lifestyle allows them to have a really reduced energy consumption. So this is an adaptation to this. They have really slow metabolic rates, about 40 to 45% what you would expect for their kind of size. They also have adaptations that help them stay basically upside down all the time. So they spend about 90% of their time hanging upside down from a tree. And so one is that most of their muscles are retractors, so instead of extensors. So they aren't very good at walking, but they can swim. Essentially, their forelimbs are more like arms than legs. They also have really long claws, which help them grip onto the trees. And they don't have much of a palm or a hand, as we might think about it, but their claws almost kind of attach almost directly to their arm. They have a symbiosis with algae that grows in their fur, and this helps them camouflage. So if you ever see pictures of sloths that look sort of greenish and maybe kind of murky looking, it's because they've got algae on them, which I guess means indicates how slow they are if algae is able to grow on them. And so they move, I think, about a foot a minute, or they can move about a foot a minute. Yeah. And so something else that I found, a myth that I found actually, have you ever heard that sloths grab their own arms thinking that they're branches? Yeah, this is something that I actually thought was true, but apparently it was a myth that was propagated by Douglas Adams, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Huh. So yeah, it's not true. They don't do that. They don't have the largest brains, but they are slightly, they're not quite that, they don't do that. But another thing that they often get like thought that they're quite lazy. And so some things, I read different kind of estimations of this. In captivity, they can sleep for about 15 to 20 hours a day. But in the wild, they're probably not going to sleep quite as often. I've read some estimates that they sleep about 8 to 9 hours. So I think they get kind of a bad reputation as being very lazy creatures. But really, this sort of slowed down lifestyle seems to be working quite well for them. These sort of adaptations help them with their lifestyle because they eat leaves and it takes them a really long time to digest. It takes them about a month sometimes to digest their food. So they can't really afford to move very much. And the final thing I want to talk about, one adaptation that I thought was really cool and that I hadn't heard of before, is that their organs are attached to their ribs so that they don't squash their lungs when they're upside down. And so this is research that was published in Biology Letters. And the reason this is because if their lungs were being squashed, it would make it harder for them to breathe, and it would be more energy inefficient. And this is really important for a sloth because they're really, because their metabolism is so low, they really need to be careful what they expend energy on, because they, their food is so hard to digest and everything is so slow for them. So their organs are attached to their ribs. Yeah.
Wow. And,
That was all my sloth facts. I felt like I'd given them a hard time, but they deserve a little bit more credit than I feel like I've given them.
You know, I always thought, must be kind of hard living up there in those trees. But now that I find out that they got to add a couple more, squish in a couple more vertebrae, attach their organs to their ribs. And, you know, the coolness factor of living in a tree your whole life just must really make it worth it for them.
Yep.
My favorite sloth fact is, do you know one of the only reasons they climb down to the forest floor?
Do tell.
To defecate.
Yeah. And then they climb back up.
If their babies fall down. I've heard it because one of the myths that I read when I was researching this was that people often say that they're bad mothers because humans will come across these sloth babies on the floor and be like, oh, they've just been abandoned. But the mother's sitting up in the tree being like, please go away so I can go get my baby. So a lot of sloths get given into wildlife sanctuaries, potentially unnecessarily.
No.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Mm.
Well, I know you guys were sitting there like I was thinking, okay, sloths, cool. But what about the snakes? I know that's on everyone's mind. I need more snakes. But I've just got a really quick one today. I did a little bit of research into arboreal snakes. And like sloths, the arboreality here means that they spend their whole lives, mostly, I mean, most of their lives. I don't know if they come down to pick up their babies, but they, or go to the bathroom, but they spend most of their lives in trees. And arboreal snakes have pretty different physiology. Before doing this research, and you know, I don't think a lot about snakes. I'm a mammal guy. It's not something that crosses my mind often. And I'm sorry, snakes, because I sort of thought, well, you got the long tube, the scales, the creepy tongue. What makes a snake? I mean, they're all the same, right? No, turns out that's wrong. There's a big difference between arboreal snakes and snakes that live on the ground. One of the main difference there is that arboreal snakes are extremely elongate. They have very thin, long bodies. And part of that thin, long bodiness is so that they can follow their prey out among the twigs to the very ends of branches without breaking the branches. And their long body allows them to distribute their weight across many different branches so that they can sort of spread their weight out carefully and closely. Another adaptation common to all of these arboreal snakes is that they have enormous eyes. I don't have a clear reason for that one, but I'm guessing because they're living in the trees, it's useful for them to be able to see to hunt. But some arboreal snakes are constrictors and some are venomous, and that doesn't really seem to have a big impact there. But the big, big difference here, and I found this was really interesting, the way that I was reading a research study sort of looking at how fast different snakes could move up a series of pegs meant to look like branches. And they noticed that when snakes like boa constrictors, which are mostly terrestrial, move upwards and up along these pegs, they use what's called concertina motion. So part of the body will stay in one place and push down while the rest of the body extends and then sort of moves to another place and then holds and grips onto somewhere. And then the whole body sort of moves like kind of like a millipede moves, where like some legs are up and some legs are down. But of course, it's ribs in the snakes. But in most arboreal snakes, they use lateral undulation instead of this concertina motion. So in the boa constrictors, some of the body is staying still and some of the body is moving. But in the snakes, the whole time, the whole body is moving. And it's sort of sliding along and using the push of friction, like a sidewinder, to push along these branches. And it helps them move faster in this environment where there's very little friction, really. They're only using friction of the branches that they're touching at the point they're touching them. So the main sort of overall and takeaway evolutionarily of this research that I found was really interesting was that arboreal snakes, like you would imagine, are constrained by body size. So whereas other snakes can get any size, big or small, well, not necessarily any size, but there's a huge range among terrestrial snakes. In arboreal snakes, there's a really low limit for the maximum body size, which is why when you see arboreal snakes, for the most part, they're pretty cute. They've got big eyes, they're really long and thin, and they're sitting there looking like a twig. I like them a lot.
You know, you said you didn't have a reason for their big eyes.
Yeah.
Aren't they mostly nocturnal?
So that's a good point. There's, in this research study I was looking at, they found that there are a lot of traits that are associated with arboreal snakes. Being nocturnal is one of them, bearing live young, eating reptiles, being patterned and banded in a certain way, and living in the neotropics are the main five traits that come with being arboreal, but they're not all connected. So it's sort of like, if I understand this properly, it's like a grab bag. Like, arboreal snakes are mostly one of those things, but not all of them, necessarily. A lot of them are nocturnal, but not all of them.
Wow, yeah, you're totally right. I really never thought about, I just thought about snakes being, you know, snake-like. I never thought that there would be sort of these more in-depth adaptations that these arboreal snakes would have. That's fascinating. So I was surprised at the differences in the arboreal snakes compared to regular snakes, but not as surprised as I was to discover that this animal can climb. Nick, do you want to elaborate a little?
Yeah. So I was looking at what could only be termed as climbing fish. Now, you don't really think of fish as climbing because you tend to think, and this might just be me, but you tend to think of fish being underwater. But yeah, there are a few examples that I wanted to bring up. So the first one is a fish you might have heard of, which is the climbing gourami. This is actually a group of fish. There's about 34 species of these, the climbing gouramis or the climbing perches. These are a type of labyrinth fishes, and labyrinth fishes possess a labyrinth organ. Makes sense, right? And what this is a structure in the fish's head which allows it to breathe atmospheric oxygen as well as oxygen underwater. And they generally entirely live in fresh water, but some can survive in brackish water, which is slightly salty water, but not as salty as seawater. And the climbing gourami might get you excited because you might think like, oh, a fish that can climb. But sadly, their name refers to something else. Their name refers for their ability to climb out of the water, not for any sort of real climbing ability as we would sort of understand in the other animals we're talking about. So the next one I wanted to talk about was the mangrove killifish. And the mangrove killifish have some amazing properties. Do you often hear the phrase, a fish out of water? These fish are weird. They are fish that are almost evolved to survive outside of water than inside of it. And this is, they're truly a weird group of animals. So one of them, the turquoise killifish of equatorial Africa, lives on average just 10 weeks. And this makes it one of the shortest lived vertebrates on Earth. The shortest lived vertebrate is another fish that lives in the coral reef, which is only 8 weeks. So it's only 2 weeks longer than the shortest lifespan of any vertebrate. Super weird fish. Most of them live under a year, which is, yeah, pretty unusual. They're sort of a really unusual type of animal. And it can breathe using gills, as you would expect from a fish. But they can also breathe through their skin. And some species, such as the mangrove killifish, can survive over 2 months on land. Yeah, staggeringly long time for a fish. And if you know anything about mangroves, is that the water level often varies quite a lot. And they're very densely packed with branches and trees and mud. And because of the leaves falling down into the water, bacteria break down these leaves and it uses a lot of oxygen from the water. It's very often a very anoxic environment, which means that to survive, quite often they have to leave the water. And they've actually got really, really good at jumping. So what they do is they sort of arch their body, they bend their body, and then they flick their tail. And some of them can, yeah, jump centimetres high and have even been observed, yeah, knocking insects off leaves a few centimetres above them in a hunting strategy. The other weird thing about the mangrove killifish is this is a very specific sentence, they're the only vertebrate hermaphrodite which can fertilise its own eggs. Even weirder is that some males do exist, which are specifically males, and they would mate sexually with the other hermaphrodites, which act as females. But these have been found living in trees, sort of. So when they jump out of the water in mangroves, obviously the water level is varied, so they might find themselves on a log. And they've actually been found inside decaying mangrove logs, living inside cavities made by insects. This is when the logs they're said to be galleried by terrestrial insects. And it's been observed in several different countries. This is the first known case of fishes entering terrestrial woody material. But again, that's not really climbing. Just because you're found in a log doesn't mean you've climbed a tree. Now, for climbing trees, you're going to have to go to Hawaii and the Hawaiian gobies, and they do something amazing. They're only about 2 centimeters long, but they have been observed scaling a 135-meter high waterfall of vertical cliffs. To give you an idea of how tall that is, that would be the equivalent of me climbing a sheer waterfall that was 11.5 kilometers high.
Good luck.
Yeah. So why would they do this? This seems like a lot of effort. Well, at the top, upstream, there is less predators and less competition for food. Downstream, before the waterfalls, obviously everything can get there quite easily. So if you can get up high, you're the only thing being able to eat the algae. So that's great news for the fish. And the only predators that are really going to find you are things like birds and stuff like that. But they're so small, like a heron's not going to really want to go eat a 2 centimeter long fish. It's not really worth their time. But before they climb, the days before they climb, something amazing happens. Their bodies actually transform. Their mouths move 90 degrees. So rather than the front of their head, it now moves to the bottom of their body. So it's now underneath them. And it can be used as a suction cup. And they've evolved another suction cup on their underside. And what it does is it uses these two combined ones where they sort of stretch and pull and stretch and pull. And they will slowly inch up the sheer cliff face. Sometimes it goes beyond vertical, so they're sort of like hanging backwards. And this journey takes days. And 99% of the fish doing this journey will die. But if they reach the top, they're in really pleasant feeding grounds. Yeah, I think, it gives them a great opportunity for when they mate to give their younglings their best opportunity.
Wow, 99% fatality rate is not good.
Not great.
Also, I wonder if they're born, like, are they born up at the top again? Do they go back down to have their babies? Because I'm like, surely if you're up there, just stay up there, you know?
I might be wrong, but I was under the impression they spawn up there, but they feed in the sea. Oh. But it's a lot easier to go down the waterfall than it is to go up it.
Yeah. And also the way that they manage to climb vertically just seems like a very extreme adaptations. They use their mouth to climb up a wall, and it's quite impressive, really. But there are other things that are able to climb vertically and even upside down.
No, that's true. Nick, earlier when you were talking about the alpine ibex, I was thinking, when we talked about snakes and sloths, we're talking about the whole body and how it sort of changes to work so that the animal can live in the tree. But with alpine ibex and with geckos, there's only one important part of the body that's really changing here, and that's the feet. For me, it was the first thing that came to mind when I thought of climbing. I wanted to introduce this topic of geckos by reviving my role as a literary correspondent and bringing in something from, well, I'll just read it first and then we can talk for a moment. But the woodpecker does not squat on the ground, but pecks at the bark of trees to drive out from under it maggots and gnats. When they emerge, it licks them up with its tongue, which is large and flat. It can run up and down a tree in any way, even with the head downwards, like the gecko lizard. Now, it's a tiny mention, but I thought, wow, if the geckos get a mention in Aristotle's History of Animals, then surely we should bring it in somehow to the natural selection. Today, I want to talk about gecko feet, and we're going to get a little bit into the, not Greek, but Latin, when we talk about the different parts of the feet. So on the feet, there are many microscopic hairs, or setae. The singular is seta. What they basically do is they're so small that when they touch the surface the gecko is climbing on, the distance between the little hairs and the surface is so small that it increases what's known as a van der Waals force, or a van der Waals force, which is sort of the attractive force between the foot and the surface that the gecko is climbing on. For us, it doesn't really impact things that we do on a daily basis with our hands because we're so big and our hands are so big. But these setae are super tiny fibers made of beta keratin, which is the same sort of thing that builds and makes our skin. So they're sort of like little hairs, but more like bristles, and about 5 micrometers in diameter. And at the end of each seta is approximately 1,000 spatulae shaped like an isosceles triangle. And these spatulae are like little, kind of like a pen that's bent at the end. Terrible description. They're like a crowbar, one end of a crowbar. So they've got a long flat bit and then the end is curved. And the curved ends are the thousands that sort of touch and attach to the surface. And it's really difficult to stick to surfaces like glass or something else that's smooth. there's not really anything to grab onto. But because all these little crowbars are sticking out of the ends of each gecko's little foot with all of its little hairs, each crowbar hooks into a little bit of the surface. And because they're so small, each one sort of holds on and adds to the adhesive force. So these spatulae, there's about 1,000 in each seta, and in each foot, there's about 14,000 setae. So each gecko foot has about 14 million spatulae. Of course, the singular is spatula. And I thought that the most interesting thing I read was on the first line of the Wikipedia article about gecko feet. It says, geckos can climb any surface except Teflon, which I thought was funny since they have spatulas all over their feet.
Hey!
That's great. So we talked a lot about different animals that climb, but another thing that came to mind when researching for this topic was plants. There are certain plants that climb. Particularly, I wanted to look at parasitic plants. So I did struggle to find specific parasitic plants. I was trying to think about vines and different things like that that climb and strangle. But I found that a lot of the time when I was looking it up, I just ended up on a gardening website. But one thing I did find, which I thought was really fascinating, so I wanted to share with you guys, a piece of research that was done, and it found a new trophic interaction. It found a parasitic plant that was attached to a sand live oak. So the plant that they found is called the love vine, or the scientific name is Cassithia filiformis. They found that it was attached to a sand live oak, but it wasn't the only thing that was parasitizing this oak. So this oak also had galls, and these are formed from different animals, but in this case, it's wasps. So what happens is the wasp burrows into the plant, and it causes it to create these sort of formations, these galls, and then it uses it as this sort of safe area to live and sometimes to have eggs and different things like that. But what was really cool about this interaction is that they found that the vine was attacking these galls and killing the wasps inside. So they found that not all of the galls, depending on the different species, it seemed to attack more. But I thought it was really interesting that this poor oak had two things that were parasitizing it. And then one of the parasites was attacking the other parasite and killing the wasp inside. So the vine seemed to feed into these galls. And I guess because they're siphoning out the nutrients from it, they seem to affect the mortality of the wasp inside. I think most of the, compared to the galls that didn't have the vines attached to them, more wasps died. So I thought that that was a really strange interaction that I found when I was looking up parasitic vines. So I thought I would share it with you guys.
That's really cool.
But yeah, cool. I think we managed to reach new heights with our theme this week. But that does bring us to the end of this episode. But don't worry, we will be back next week where we'll be talking all about sex. Thank you guys for joining us this week. And thank you for sharing your news and research with us. So until next time, that is goodbye.
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 Are they the ones that sit there in those videos on TikTok or whatever and like look at the camera and then go, wap, wap, wap? No.
No, that's humans.
I'm not sure. Oh.